Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Of the 44 presidents that have led the United States, three have been truly great, says my guest today, Washington, Lincoln, FDR. Each faced a major national crisis. Each brought the country through. For some time now, greatness in the White House has become scarce, says Aaron David Miller. He says the time of great presidents is over, that what we need is just really good presidents. This hour on Point, the great, the good, and who will effectively lead America. Joining me now from Washington is Aaron David Miller, Vice President and Distinguished Scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, former U.S. diplomat. He's written a lot about the Middle East. His new book is The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. You can find an excerpt from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Aaron David Miller, welcome back to On Point.
Pleasure to be here, Tom.
It's nice to talk with you about something other than the Middle East for a change. Thank you for
stretching out there.
The
truth is that the world is in such a state of disarray that I started life as an American historian, and I find myself coming full circle because I really do believe in the promise of the United States and the capacity over time perhaps to come to terms with some of the problems that ail us, which certainly doesn't look terribly encouraging in the Middle East right now.
The questions that you pose here are interesting. You say, can America have another undeniably great president? And even if we could, would we want one? We'll go back and look at what you mean by great. I want to spend some time with that, but let's just pick up the first piece there first. You raise doubt. I mean, it's right there in your title that we'll have great presidents again. Why not?
Well, I argue that there are three C's that are critically important to produce what I describe as an undeniably great president. That is crisis of a nation encumbering character, so hot, so relentless, so inescapable, that it domesticates the political system, creates a measure of acquiescence in our difficult politics. And if, in fact, the president has the other two C's, character and capacity, can actually provide an extraordinary opportunity for the right person not only to weather the crisis but to extract out of it some measure, some piece of transformative change on how we look at ourselves, how we govern ourselves, that fundamentally changes the country forever for the better. And I argue 44 presidents, actually 43 different presidents. Grover Cleveland was president twice in two non-consecutive terms. Out of these 43 different presidents, only three fit the bill because only those three saw the right alignment, the sun, the moon, and the stars, crisis, character, and capacity to actually produce undeniable greatness. And I spend a bit of time trying to describe why they are undeniably great. I just believe, Tom, 12 presidents and down and counting now since our last undeniable great presidents, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that the trend lines against greatness, that kind of greatness, are really not running in the right direction.
But why
and
not?
There are several elements that have conspired to reduce the odds. I'm not here to give up hope. I'm not here. I'm not a declinist. I do believe we face a leadership crisis in this country. Why not undeniably greatness? Four reasons. Number one, there is no way any president is likely to be able to overcome the FDR high bar. And this is something that's incredibly important because FDR has informed our expectations. And the sense of expectation on the part of all of his successors. A man who was a crisis president for four terms, didn't serve them all out. And the Republicans, in an effort to get even with FDR in 1951, passed the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution, restricting the president to two terms. But what they did, paradoxically, was enshrine FDR's greatness forever because no president again could ever serve more than two terms. So that's one thing. I call it FDR's high bar.
So that's sort of unique to FDR. But
exactly. A peacetime crisis president. He didn't fix the Great Depression. World War II did that. But he inspired enough confidence, experimented enough in order to get the country through and created some pretty extraordinary legislative efforts during that period, and then, of course, helped lead America through its last good war.
Okay, so he had four terms. That's
yes.
a long time. That's not going to be repeated unless the Constitution is changed. But
exactly.
no one expects us to run out of crises. Many would say we're in any number right now, any number that could grow substantially longer. Why would we think there would not be more leaders to come, men? And or women with the character and capacity, why shouldn't that triad come together again?
Well, I'm arguing, again, the second reason is that we haven't had the kind of nation-encumbering crisis which forces the domestication and the taming of the political system. We have plenty of crises. I call them the six deadly deeds, slow bleeds, debt, deficit, dysfunctional politics, decaying infrastructure, a disastrous educational system, dependence on hydrocarbons. And there are more, including climate change. There are more. But these, I would argue, Tom, are not the relentless, inescapable, urgent crises that essentially serve to unite us as the traditional crises have done and provide the kinds of opportunities required for true greatness in the presidency. They tend to polarize. They tend to enhance and deepen our political dysfunction. So paradoxically, I'm arguing that we don't want another great president because greatness in our political system is driven first and foremost by nation-encumbering crisis.
I
don't want one of those. Mm-hmm. We were fortunate to have great leaders to guide us through the three most extraordinary crises the nation faced. You know, nations are like individuals. They go through formative periods in their development. If they survive the early years, and we did, perhaps they're guaranteed a relatively long life. I just think that we need to fundamentally reorient our expectations and add the other two reasons other than FDI's high bar and the mm-hmm. absence of mm-hmm. a profoundly nation-encumbering crisis. Mm-hmm. Add to that the dysfunctional nature of our politics and the fact that it's very difficult and mistrust of government, the fact that it's very difficult for presidents to harness government as reform and as remedy these days. And finally, the presence of an intrusive 24/7 media which strips away the mystique and authority from any president and has created a situation which the president in many respects literally has become one voice among many in a cacophony of voices. Just one example, when Jack Kennedy addressed the nation on October 22nd, 1962, at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the networks, Michael Beschloss, the historian, tells us, literally went back immediately to normal programming. There wasn't 24
wow.
hours of buildup before or 24 hours after,
yeah.
which meant, Tom, think about it, which meant that my parents, I was 12 at the time, I probably didn't even watch this speech. Mm-hmm. My parents had to sit and listen to their president without any mediation or commentary mm-hmm. from anyone else. Mm-hmm. They had to judge him. They had to evaluate him. And there were relationships and bonds between the public and their presidents which, frankly, have fundamentally changed in the modern period.
Could we back up to, you say, it's almost the first requirement of a great president, truly great emerging, is this a profoundly nation-encumbering crisis.
Exactly.
Your suggestion is that we don't face one that fits that description right now and that we may not for some time. That raises the question, are you saying that this country is too strong to have that kind of crisis, because beneath whatever strength we have, and it's substantial, and I see you're not a declinist, I'm not in that camp either, but you know the fear out there is that strong as we may be, it's bleeding away. And crises are building unaddressed. I mean, all the way to climate change, which could change the whole planet, that there's plenty of crisis around.
Yes.
If only it were acknowledged. Are we too strong or feel too strong or live in an illusion of strength that somehow cuts us off from rising to crises that are there?
Tom, I think you've identified so many wonderful points that contribute to the problem. The absence of shared sacrifice, shared obligation, a common sense of what defines us as Americans, all of these things, I think, complicate this notion that somehow we need to be more energized, more focused on addressing these slow bleeds. But there's a more fundamental factor, I think, and that goes back to what the founders and the framers actually created. They feared the royal governors. They feared the king. They wanted a strong and energetic executive, particularly Hamilton, but they also wanted one who was constrained and accountable. And they created a political system of shared and separated powers, which, in my judgment, makes the accretion of power, assuming you have the right individual mm-hmm. that is has character and knows what he and one day she is doing, to basically know how to manage it. They built in some respects, a ready-made situation that would only allow this kind of greatness to emerge in response to a crisis that was so profound that the nation had no choice but to face it as a whole. Look at 9/11. 9/11 was a rare moment in American history, and there aren't that many in the modern period that bring us together as a nation.
And yet
mm-hmm. look what happened. 9/11 gave rise to the two longest wars in American history, yeah. wars that were fought by 0.5% of a country of 300 million people.
Yeah.
9/11 became not an inclusive crisis where we were forged in some sense of national identity around some broader issue. It became exclusive, fought by a volunteer army in a highly sophisticated national security state. We were told to go out and shop.
Or David Middle, hold the thought, because we still have those slow bleeds that are really substantial crises in themselves. What about leadership in that situation? The End of Greatness is the book. Presidential Power, Great and Good is the subject. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about great presidents, good presidents, and what the United States needs now, needs next, what's likely available to this country. Aaron David Miller joins us from Washington. He is author of the new book, The End of Greatness. Who's a great president? What makes a great president? Well, there's a lot of sound of it out there, elements of it anyway, or otherwise, depending on your view. Here's JFK, 1961.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Ronald Reagan, 1987, at the Brandenburg Gate, the Berlin Wall.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
And last Wednesday at the White House, President Barack Obama.
I want people to understand that the dangers of you contracting Ebola, the dangers of a serious outbreak, are extraordinarily low. But we are taking this very seriously at the highest levels of government. And we are going to be able to manage this particular situation.
Great president. Lots of response here online on Facebook. Chris says the one we have there now is pretty impressive given the day in and day out slander he has to work with. Coast says a good president would be better than Obama. So a couple of views there. And Paul says great presidents are defined by the age they live in. Times and circumstances make them great. Aaron David Miller has a kind of formula here. We've heard a piece of it. We'll hear more. His new book is The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. You're quite high. We'll look more at greatness. You're quite high on good, just having a good president. Why is that enough?
Well, I'm arguing good, Tom, not in the banal sense of the word. We've lost touch, I think, with the essence and nature of goodness. Good to me means three things, and it may mean three things. Good means effective and competent. We need presidents with experience who know how to run things and know what they're doing. Second, good in the sense that they have moral sensibility and remain within the confines of the law. It was Harry Truman who quipped that Nixon may have read the Constitution, but he didn't understand mm-hmm. it. And finally, we need good in the sense that these presidents have emotional intelligence. They're comfortable in their own skin. They're not driven by unrealized and unrealistic aspirations which get them into trouble, or by demons that haunt them in the way Nixon had demons and even Lyndon Baines Johnson. And by the way, let me just make one point. It is common knowledge and it is appreciated by historians, pundits, political scientists that Washington, Lincoln, and FDR, one in each century, 18th, 19th, and 20th, are our three undeniably great presidents. I discuss eight additional presidents mm-hmm. who were not faced with what I would call nation-encumbering crises. And yet they were in some respects, very effective. Five, I call the close but no cigar presidents, mm-hmm. who in some respects define their age, Jefferson, Jackson, Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, arguably, and Harry Truman, and an additional three in the modern period, who I believe had traces of greatness, real or perceived. You actually played clips by two of them. Mm. One, Jack Kennedy. That speech you played, the Ask Not speech, mm-hmm. was the last great inaugural address, truly great inaugural address. That's 60 years ago.
Yeah.
The other two are LBJ for Medicare, Medicaid, and three extraordinary civil rights bills. And yes, Ronald Reagan, despite all of his deficits, who in fact deserves enormous credit for reaching out to Gorbachev and harnessing his own pragmatic instincts to create a frame of reference which brought the Cold War to an end, together, of course, with contradictions and anomalies in the Soviet system and Gorbachev, mm-hmm. who deserves most of the credit. Mm. We have not had, since Reagan, that kind of frame of reference, in large part because I would argue to you our expectations are too high. And second, in expecting our presidents to be great, we create and push them to create an unrealistic frame of reference for ourselves. Look at Barack Obama, extremely competent, faced with a very difficult hand, the longest and deepest economic crisis since the Great Depression, the two longest wars in American history. And yet he tried to create a frame of reference of transformation. He believed, I would argue wrongly, that the country wanted transformation. I don't think the country wanted transformation in 08. They wanted off the roller coaster ride of a bad economy and two very long wars. And yet Barack Obama, perhaps understandably, all presidents disappoint, took America to the mountaintop, sworn in on the Lincoln
rhetorically.
Bible.
Rhetorically.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sworn in on the Lincoln Bible, recreated part of Lincoln's train journey from Baltimore to Washington, mm-hmm. literally recreated the very lunch served on replicas of Mary Todd Lincoln's China.
So what?
That Lincoln consumed. Well, it creates, Tom, a measure of expectation that, in fact, the president is going to be different. He promised in his inaugural that the dry, stale political arguments no longer apply. He promised postpartisanship in an era of a shark-infested political culture.
Is it his fault that he didn't get that?
Well,
or is it the fault of that culture
no.
that surrounds him, all the fins
I
in the
think
water?
I think it's part the reality is when you don't read the real estate correctly, mm-hmm. and all our great presidents do mm-hmm. I think you end up creating a sense of expectation that can only disappoint. You have a president now, his own party running from him in states like Virginia and North Carolina.
You said extremely competent, and I just want to come back and test that for a moment. I mean, we saw the rollout of the Obamacare website. We have seen the Ebola response in recent weeks. Are you standing by that at October, the second year of the second term, extremely competent?
I'm suggesting to you that having inherited the two longest wars in American history and the deepest economic recession since the Great Depression, that in fact, there in many instances, this president has moved the country out of its severe crisis into something that offers the promise, it seems to me, of more normalcy. It's been grudging. People don't feel it as broadly and as widely as they should. And yes, the incompetency and the lack of experience in governance has come back to haunt Barack Obama. There's no question about it. But a failed president, as his detractors, mm-hmm. or a catastrophically failed president, as his detractors suggest, or some sort of redeemer and savior, the so-called one, mm-hmm. as his proponents and his defenders suggest, no. Barack Obama inherited a bad hand. He's done some very good things for this country. But you know, JFK, LBJ, FDR, there's probably not going to be a BHO.
Aaron David Miller's new book is The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Stand by in Washington, if you would. Aaron Bruce is calling from Essex, Massachusetts. Bruce, you're on the air.
Tom, your guest's yearning for a man on a white horse is frightening in that it is universal. He hopes for a crisis that brings greatness. Now, first of all,
I don't know if that's a fair characterization. He says that crises have brought greatness. I don't hear him yearning for another crisis, but what about, we certainly have problems aplenty. What about a man on a white horse, that whole deal?
Tom.
Yes.
Look, a leader is somebody who is able to say, this is where we are, there is where we need to be, and these are the steps that get us there. A leader is somebody who keeps crises from happening, such as the president that seems to be left off the list, Dwight Eisenhower, who he was not made supreme commander of the European theater in World War II because he had a position that Germany should be defeated. It was because he had demonstrated the ability to make plans. Our problem right now is that the emphasis is on, as your guest seems to feel, greatness is revealed in speeches, not actions.
Bruce, again, I'm very intrigued by what you're saying. I'm not sharing your characterization of what Aaron David Miller's saying, but let me ask you, how do we get the country to line up behind this calm, cool planner who you'd like to see in office? Not a man on a white horse, but an effective planner. Aaron David Miller is saying that Americans just won't line up behind a leader without a crisis to get them in line.
Well, first of all, the problem is that leadership does not even enter into it. Positions. The idea now of who should be president is similar to, say, if Tom Cruise likes chocolate cake and ice cream, and you like chocolate cake and ice cream, why, he should be president. There is no leadership being offered by anybody.
Bruce, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. The leadership fact, I'm not sure how we define leadership here, but Aaron, David Miller, some have said that Obama, despite his tremendous rhetoric, that's where he falls down in some way, because he hasn't, I mean, they're very resistant to being herded, but he can't herd the cats. He can't put out a message that overcomes the resistance, the opposition, and gets people behind policies in spite of their reluctance. Is that leadership, or would it be?
I think the notion somehow, and this is why I am so against, either I haven't been clear enough and articulate enough in identifying what I'm arguing, or Bruce, who actually makes a very good point with respect to identifying means, ends, and then a way forward, hasn't been listening. I'm actually arguing against this notion of high-sounding rhetoric, greatness in the presidency, unrealistic expectations, because what happens, and in many respects, Barack Obama is the poster child for our misconception. We believe that if President X is elected with a mandate, a good win. And Obama had a good win, both in the popular vote and in the Electoral College.
Yep.
In the Electoral College, much like Clinton's. Mm-hmm. He then goes out and articulates grand designs in bold and transformative fashion. And somehow, in between the speech and the objective, the opposition just melts away and the constituents all rise to support him.
Well, that's what Obama seems to have expected himself somehow.
Exactly. That's why presidential rhetoric has to be rooted in reality. It has to be rooted in deed. And you cannot separate the man or one day woman from the office itself. There's a great line that Jack Kennedy loved in Richard IV. One character, Glendower, says to Hotspur, "I can summon the spirits from the vasty deep." And Hotspur responds, "But so can any man. The question is, do they come when you call
you
them?
You can call, but do they come?"
Right. And that in essence, is the question. Our great presidents and our consequential ones understood the real estate. They understood the circumstances in which they were trapped and which constrained them. And they found a way to work within those and exploit and enlarge the opportunities at their disposal. When Lincoln became president, the idea of emancipating the slaves and an Emancipation Proclamation might have been on his mind at some point, but he didn't openly come out and somehow suggest to the nation that this, in essence, is what he was going to do. He had to wait. There were other priorities, which were transactional, fighting a war, keeping the border states in line, keeping his own party in line. His own cabinet, as Doris Kearn Goodwin tells us. Mm-hmm. And Lincoln intuited what the real estate was. And by 1862, 1863, understood that in essence, he could get what he wanted, create a new moral foundation for the nation, sold as a wartime measure. It was the right blend, Tom, of pragmatism and principle. Mm-hmm. And what produced it, frankly, was a crisis so severe, a character so ennobling, and a capacity so smart that you, in essence, got heroic things done. We need a transactional president, Tom, not a transformational one. We need someone who knows how to build coalitions. We need someone who understands the real estate. We need someone who's prepared to engage with Congress, even though it may appear that there is no opportunity.
And Mill, hold the thought if you'd be good enough. Yeah. The book is The End of Greatness. Here's the thing that concerns me, that you say we need a transactional, not transformative, yet many of the crises we face, though not all of them, this could change, but many, as you say, are slow bleeds. Look at climate change. But people might say, well, it's not so slow, and we need to get going, and the changes that would have to be accomplished to address it are in some measure transformational changes. You say we can't get a great president with this kind of crisis, but I wonder if a transactional president, or a good president, as you put it, is enough to address the scale of our slow bleed crises.
That is going to be told and only revealed in the doing, and I think it in some respects comes down to the one issue that has driven our dysfunctional politics. The one issue, and it's not abortion, it's not prayer in the public school, it's not even gun control. It is the role of government, the appropriate role of government, in addressing the ails and challenges of the nation.
We've got a caller right on that point, if yes. I may. Patrick in Madison, Wisconsin. Patrick, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I've heard that Ronald Reagan is a great president, but Ronald Reagan's done more to divide our nation than any modern president. When he said government is not the solution, government is the problem. Kennedy brought us together with a similar phrase, but Reagan told the nation that government is the problem. And certain parties have been using this ideal ever since to divide the nation. Isn't government is the problem? Isn't that anarchy?
Patrick, I appreciate your call. Is that the snare around our ankles right there, Aaron?
I would argue that it is a huge part of it, because if the two major parties cannot agree, forget what government does or what the size of government is. And by the way, there is no going back. 75% of people in this country benefit in one way or another, if you include tax breaks, including mortgage deductions, from some government program or some form of largesse. I remember that Tea Party rally. I think I quoted in my book, the antithesis of Barack Obama. Couldn't stand him, protesting against him. And yet one of the signs says, Obama, don't touch my Medicare. The reality is big government is in some respects here to stay. The question is how to make it effective and how to make it politically palatable. And that's a huge problem. We're way, way, way beyond the idea of going back to a pre-World War II American political state, when the average American's contact with government was either through the military or the U.S. post office. We've come a long way for that, and we have to get real about what government can't do, but also that it can be used as an effective force for reform and remedy.
This is On Point. We're talking this hour about great presidents, good presidents, and what the United States needs now, needs next. Aaron David Miller is my guest. His new book is The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. What does a great president sound like? Last one, he says, FDR.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
First inaugural, right out of the gate there, FDR in 1933. Sound of another president, January 1961. On the other end of his presidency, Dwight D. Eisenhower ended his term with a warning to the nation about the growing power of the military-industrial complex.
We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961. Aaron David Miller joins us from Washington. Lots commenting online. Here we've got David says, hard to envision a president who isn't loathed by 50% of the country and beloved by the other 50%. Ashley writes, of course presidents and politicians aren't great anymore. They're corrupted by money and undereducated in things that matter, not to mention morally bankrupt. Ooh, no, that's not much going there. Diane says, as for Obama, he couldn't please the 40% on the right if he walked on water and turned coal into gold. Another kind of rolling coal there. Brady in Killington, Vermont. Brady, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I want to make a couple of points. I think that, first of all, the media has to drop the Ebola thing. You know, 20,000 people are going to die from the flu this year, and a few in America are going to die from Ebola. And it's just, they did not drop the ball on Ebola. Obama didn't drop the ball on Ebola. Like, Reagan let 25,000 people die of HIV before the government even started to respond to HIV.
Hey, Brady, I take your point, but and I'll go to your others, but I just want to address that one because I do not agree with you for this reason. I don't think Ebola would be a big deal if people saw plenty of competence all over the place in other areas. I don't think it's just the media driving it, though sure there's an element of that. I think it's because they see a context in which too many things are not being addressed. And when the government comes out and says we're going to stop it cold, we're going to stop it in its tracks, and they don't, people think, you know, OMG, here we go again, and we don't want it with Ebola. But what's your other point, Brady?
Okay. So I think Obama is doing brilliantly, and it's not being acknowledged because he's working, he's playing chess. He's working 10 steps out in foreign policy, and he's getting other countries to finally step up and do some work. He's getting NATO to act like NATO. He's getting the Middle East to finally start policing itself, and so that the United States does not have to act unilaterally to take care of its own interests.
Okay, let us run with that, Brady, and thank you. Aaron David Miller. Cool Hand Luke, 10 steps ahead. He's playing chess. You're judging too quickly, others as well, and too harshly. Obama's actually changing the board here.
I'm not sure. He's caught in a situation, largely, perhaps, and we'll see what happens in the midterms, whether or not you end up with a Republican House and Senate. A divided government, by the way, Tom, has a better record of producing legislation than one in which you've got, you know, complete and utter partisan dominance. It may well be that perhaps in the less than 1,000 days that remains in Obama's presidency, maybe something can get done. I don't see it that way. I don't think the vast majority of the country sees it that way. If they did, this was just a matter of bad PR, you'd have a much different sort of reaction. No, there's a pervasive uncertainty, a pervasive fear and sense of insecurity here. It's ISIS, it's Ebola. It's an economic recovery that has not felt by millions of Americans. And it's a sense, I suspect, that in many respects, what you have is a president that is detached and analytical and truly Cool Hand Luke. But I'm not entirely persuaded that you can have a president that is hands-off, particularly with respect to Congress. Whether or not there was an alternative course of action, whether or not, and I believe that health care in this country to a large degree is a moral right, but I think the transformative character of what the president tried to do on health care, the polarization which developed, the stress of the system, the fact that a set of legislation, Affordable Health Care Act, passed the Congress, not a single vote from the opposite party. Most of the transformative moments in this country's history, and there haven't been that many, were inherently partisan by partisan presidents, but they end up assembling broad bipartisan coalitions. And as a consequence, they were authoritative, they were legitimate, and they endured. I'm not entirely persuaded that that may well be the future for healthcare, particularly if Barack Obama is not succeeded by a Democrat. So, no, I think he deserves a lot of credit for a lot of things. But during the 6th plus 7th year of his presidency, I think there are fundamental doubts right now about where the country is going, and broad popular discontent with his leadership.
I think those fundamental doubts are what are going to bring people to your subject here, people looking for the way out of this sense of paralysis and doubt, hoping for a leader that will make that happen. Amir in Dennis, Massachusetts, you're on.
Tom, how are you?
All right, what do you see?
You know, a good president, let alone a great president, leads the country. And, you know, in reference to Mr. Miller's point about the hand President Obama was dealt, you're dealing with a financial crisis, which he simply furthered the policies that Bush already put in place. In regard to the honorable withdrawal out of Iraq, he did so despite of many of the warnings of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, including Leon Panetta, who just recently wrote a book about it. And you can see the crisis now dealing with ISIS. In regards to coming into the country, you know, closing down Guantanamo Bay, which I was in favor of, it's still open. In regards to Syria and its red line, Russia was the country that negotiated the peace, not the president.
So what kind of president do you want now? Do you want next, Amir?
I want a president that can just tell the truth and is believable. I mean, you have a president that mocks a Republican challenger for talking about the threat of Russia. And right after the Olympic Games, Russia invades Ukraine. And there really everything has been after the fact. There's nothing been in front of it.
So get out front, you say. Someone who leans forward. But does that take us over a cliff?
Even the decisions to make the managers. I mean, you know, sometimes Bush said, you know, it's not really, I don't think the smartest guy in the room. I just, you know, find smarter people. I mean, he appoints a manager who is a chief of staff of the vice president, two vice presidents.
To oversee the Ebola operations,
To oversee the Ebola operation when he has no medical experience whatsoever. Dr. Friedman, at the head of the CDC, was not good. Supposedly, this you know, chief of staff is going
to
be the answer.
Well, give him a chance, but I take your point. You've got to appoint good people to get good things to happen. Roger in Atlanta. Roger, you're on.
Hi. Yeah, it's actually really great that my point is coming after
Amir there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My point was I was very interested in the JFK comment your guest made earlier, and that was that people used to look to a president as someone who was a singular leader, and now we don't see that anymore. Now a presidency is something different, and it's probably always been this way, but now the public knows it as well. A president is his cabinet or her cabinet. A president is a series of appointments, and a president is not going to be a singular solution like we used to think of the presidency. That's really my major point. But then also something that I struggle with, and I this also responds to the previous caller's Guantanamo Bay comment, is I'm not so sure that and I think I'm not alone in this, that the American people believe that a president has the power to change things anymore. I believe, honestly, that Obama wanted to close Guantanamo Bay,
sure,
for instance, but then he gets into office and is unable to do so because of the National Security Agency and various things.
Roger, we've got it, and I appreciate your call from Atlanta. I want to get a couple more, then we're going to take it home with Aaron David Miller. Mike in Milwaukee, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to lighten this conversation with a quote from the great political journalist of the 20s, H.L. Mencken.
Oh, good.
This was on the election of Calvin Coolidge.
Yeah, I'm here.
Well,
yes? Give us the quote, Mike.
Oh, yeah. He said, on the election of Coolidge, it's as though a starving man offered a banquet table laden end to end with the most exquisite preparations of the French cuisine, elected instead to catch and eat flies.
Well, you're saying President Obama chose to go for the little stuff?
No, I just said that in essence, we do need greatness. We don't need Calvin Coolidge mediocrity.
Go for the feast. Go for the big. And we'll get one more Mike and come to you, Aaron, David Miller. Mike in Wayland, Massachusetts, you're on.
Hi, yes. I just had to call before my head exploded and my mouth wouldn't work anymore.
Oh, good. I'm glad you got in before that happened.
Yes, exactly. Your guest, though he makes some points that I would say have some credibility, I think he's just he's tunnel-focused on the president, and he's ignoring the big picture. When this president took office, the Republican Party, the head of the Republican Party, boasted, openly saying they would defy him at every pass along the way.
Yes, they did.
When you've got a divided, he said we get more done with a, your guest mentioned this a few minutes ago, we get more done with a divided House. So his point is the Republicans would control House and Senate, the president would be on themselves. Well, look what we've got with a Senate controlled by the Democrats and by the Republicans in the House. He is so wrong on so many fronts on this. The health care, I watched the president sit down in the room with all the Republicans.
Yep.
I've never seen that done before, and he ate their lunch. They looked like a bunch of schoolboys trying to tattle on him. It was, this guy is so wrong. I asked him how many American soldiers have died with all the dictators that have been dethroned by the people in their country.
Hey, Mike, we've got it. This adamant resistance was going to be in Obama's path no matter what, and yet that's part of the picture Aaron David Miller is trying to paint here. We do have that divided country. I'll get one more. We're looking at greatness and goodness in the White House. Got to get Sybil in New Orleans. Sybil, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to say that you all and people who are calm, they're dancing around the issue. The whole issue is racism. This president, because he's the first black president ever, people wanted him to fail. They did, the Congress did everything, the opposite party did everything in their power to make sure this president failed.
Sybil, I understand Congress. That. I understand that. But are you sure? Because we've got big issues. And if we do ultimately fail as a nation, everybody goes down. So wouldn't even a racist fear that?
If you had a Congress that was willing to work with this president on many of the issues, but when you have a Congress that walks out and refuses to work with this president, sets him up, they want to set him up from day one as a failure and don't want to acknowledge any accomplishments that this president, any black president or opposite race president, maybe even some other Native American president, they would face some of the same issues.
Sybil, our time is short. Let us pick that up and go. Aaron David Miller, here we are. We've got big crises in front of us, even if they're slow bleeds. They're enormous. And some are not so slow, and more may emerge. What's the profile? And how does the race factor come into it? Because we are a very and increasingly diverse country. Sort of craft the key for us that would fit the lock to take us effectively forward.
I wish I could. My friend David Greenberg, a tremendous historian at Rutgers, argues why last chapters of books always disappoint. I propose three relatively modest suggestions here. And remember, I wrote this book to start a conversation. And frankly, Tom, it's been extraordinary because I've succeeded. Your callers have been terrific in their comments.
Well, people feel the need. We've got to get out of this swamp.
And clearly energized.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, we need to read more history and understand when and why things happen in this country. Number two, we really have to separate out this notion that our president is somehow a cross between Harrison Ford and Air Force One and Superman. We really have to be much more respectful of the circumstances in which a president actually operates, but hold that president to account for reading the real estate and reality of his current situation correctly. I do not agree with your caller. Race is still alive. Ferguson demonstrates that.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is Barack Obama was reelected. He was reelected, and enough people in this country, both black and white, believed in him to vote for him a second time.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean we're not gridlocked enough to frustrate him even after election.
No, I agree. And that means, was there a plan, was there an alternative course that Barack Obama could have pursued? Some argue no, that race and the Republicans were simply determined and destined to sink him. I'm not sure about that.
Mm-hmm.
I come back to the notion that if you set a transformative agenda for yourself. In a country that largely is conservative by nature and transactional in character and wanted off the roller coaster ride, that you really do set yourself up for a fall. Let me just quote John Steinbeck, who wrote in the 60s the following. We give the president more work than a man can do, more responsibility than a man should take, more pressure than a man can bear. We abuse him often and rarely praise him. We wear him out, use him up, eat him up. And with all this, Americans have a love for the president that goes beyond loyalty or party nationality. He is ours, and we exercise the right to destroy him. I wrote this book to start a conversation about greatness and goodness in the presidency. This office belongs to all of us. The word I is mentioned only twice in our Constitution, only twice, because the inaugural oath is embedded in that document, because the founders understood that the real power and authority is not the president or the presidency. It is us, and we need to begin to take a much more sober, realistic, and involved role in our own politics.
Aaron David Miller, plenty of opportunities to exercise that thoughtfulness coming right up. We are headed into the midterms, and you know what comes right behind. It'll be 2016 talk all the time. The new book is The End of Greatness, Why Americans Can't Have and America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Aaron David Miller, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.